The Committee of Higher Education and Workforce Development will be in order. Today's date is Thursday, January 22nd. So thank you very much. Before we begin with today's business, we have a special treat. Senator Claussen is going to introduce his mentee. So Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, it's my privilege, actually, to introduce Carolyn Henke. And I'm going to ask Carolyn to go up to the end here of the table and sit down in front of those mics. And a little bit about Carolyn. Carolyn is a senior at Eastview High School in the Rosemont-Apple Valley-Eagan Public Schools. And there is a mentor program in the school district. And for 13 weeks, the student will be taking a course where they look at career options and they actually do some research on a career that they like to pursue. And then they spend 13 weeks assigned to a mentor and doing hands-on experiences. So Carolyn has been doing a number of things that I'll let her talk about. And one of the happy moments here recently with Carolyn, she's been admitted to the University of Minnesota, which was her goal the first day I met her.
So Carolyn, hi, go ahead. Carolyn. So say your name for the record, and then just tell us just a couple minutes about your experience.
Okay, I am Carolyn Handke, and I started shadowing Senator Claussen in November. It was a little tricky at first because they weren't in session, so I had to kind of do some random stuff, but that was really fun. I went to a few meetings with him, one about developing a homeless shelter in Dakota County, which was extremely interesting because I had some input on that too. And then I also went to the North Star Summit Higher Education Committee or conference, I mean. I think that was in December. Yeah. And Senator Bonhoeff was there as well. And then Senator Claussen has set me up with some really good contacts that I've been meeting. I met with a woman from an organization called Breaking Free about human trafficking. So I had a conversation with her. And for the past couple days, a few days last week, and then earlier today, I was shadowing lobbyist John Call. So I've just been doing a lot of different stuff involved with government and organizations around there. And it's been a great experience for me because I just wanted to kind of get to know what was happening in my government, or the government, I mean. And, yeah, it's been great. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for being here, and congratulations on
your
acceptance to the University of Minnesota. And you're in for a treat today because that's who's presenting, is the University of Minnesota.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. So I will be calling forward the first presenter, who's Dr. Brian Herman, our Vice President for Research at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. And I guess Mr. Fitzenreiter is also going to sit up there at this point, too, and they'll go back and forth. I do have some regents in the room. I would just like to have them stand and be acknowledged. Chair Beeson, Chair Devine, if you want to stand. Any other regents? And we have some regent candidates in the room. And I didn't acknowledge you last time, but I noticed some have continued to come. So if you would stand up and be acknowledged for if you're a regent candidate. So I see Ms. Prawl, Mr. Hsu. Oh, very good. Mr. Anderson, thank you so much for being here today. All right. I'll turn it over to
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's honestly great to be back. looking forward to a robust discussion today. We have a lot of material to share with you. I do want to give greetings from the President. I know he's looking forward to coming back here to discuss the budget in the very near future, we hope. And I'm going to sort of orchestrate people today and answer questions as we go along. And our first presenter today is Dr. Brian Herman, who will give you an update on a very successful program of funding that you folks provided us a year and a half ago in the last biennial budget go-round regarding MnDrive. So,
and I will say, and you are such a pro because you've been doing this years and years, you forgot to say your name for the tape.
No, and I wrote that down too. When I, for the record, my name is Richard Fitzenreiter. I go by Fitz. I'm CFO and treasurer at the University of Minnesota.
Thank you very much. Dr. Herman.
So, Madam Chair, Senators, I'm Dr. Brian Herman, the Vice President for Research at the University of Minnesota, and I wanted to bring you up to speed on how we've been allocating and investing the resources that you so graciously provided us in the last biennium for an activity called Minnesota Discovery Research and Innovation Economy, or MinDrive. As you remember, this is a program that was bringing together the needs of the economic industries of our state with the academic excellence of the university and being overseen and supported by the legislature. The program has been in existence now for about a year and a half, and the first slide shows that in that first year and a half, we've already hired and created 173 new jobs, and those jobs are across a number of different kinds of categories. So we've hired 22 of 27 new faculty members at the university across six different colleges. We've supported 61 graduate students across seven colleges, 31 postdoctoral and clinical fellows across the university, and then 23 undergraduate students and 36 staff. So you can see that within a relatively short amount of time, we've had a major impact in increasing the excellence at the university through the hiring and the support of a number of different students and faculty. We've also been very active, as the next slide shows, in providing support for a broad range of projects at the university. And to date, we have supported 120 different projects across 20 colleges and three campuses. And so we have been able to invest this money wisely, but also impact a number of colleges and campuses within the University of Minnesota system. And to date, about 280 proposals for outside funding have been submitted. And I would tell you that the average turnaround time for funding is about 9 months from the submission of a proposal. And to date, we've had about $19 million awarded from federal agencies such as the National Institutes of Health, National Science Foundation, USDA, and most importantly, a number of private corporations, including many of those that are located here in the state of Minnesota. Specifically to that latter point, we've engaged 100 different industry partners in this process to date, and many of our investments require matches from our industry partners, and so we think that this has been a highly successful initiation of bringing the university and the economic engines of the state of Minnesota closer together and better aligned. That $19 million represents a 40% return on the investment of the MinDrive dollars to date. So we also think that that's a substantial early success in that investment strategy.
So, Dr. Herman, if you wouldn't mind, could we, when people have questions, just kind of do it during, or would you rather wait till you're done with your presentation?
Whatever pleases the panel is fine with me.
Thank you. So, Dr. Herman, what is the nature of, though, when you say the match? Can you just give us some sense of what does the match look like? What does the partnership look like? Just give us one example so we can.
So one example would be we have a partnership with PepsiCo where they are actually paying some of their scientists and leasing space from the university to place their scientists close by to our academic faculty that are working collaboratively on joint projects mm-hmm. that are of common interest to the company and to the university. So that would be one example. A second example is that we will partner with industry where industry will provide partial funding and support for the research activity that would occur under the aegis of MinDrive investments. So that would be a second kind of example. A third kind of example would be that there are companies, as you'll see in this slide, who have already shown interest in the acquisition of the new knowledge through intellectual property and commercialization mm-hmm. activity that has been stimulated by MinDrive, and so they'll make an investment in acquiring that intellectual property from the university. So there are a variety of different kinds of partnerships and kinds of mechanisms by which industry is partnering with the university under this program.
Very exciting. Is that a trade secret what the PepsiCo scientists are working on? I was just trying to think. What are the PepsiCo scientists?
Let me say that publicly they're supporting work in they're funding a soybean chair at the university. So
okay.
It's in the area of soybean production.
Thank you. Okay, very good. Looks like no other questions right now.
So then the last bit of information I thought would be interesting for you to know about is that, and again, this is within a relatively brief time, that we've already had 31 patents disclosure and intellectual property activities stimulated out of this investment. And this is really important for the university and important as a process to move forward our intellectual property into society. Within a year and a half, it's generated 350-some-odd publications. It's really engaged 10,000 individuals through a variety of meetings, conferences, workshops, community outreach. And this has resulted in the generation of 30-some-odd new courses that have come out of the support of MnDrive to create new opportunities for more collaborative kinds of activities across the areas that MnDrive supports. So we think that this has been a very successful start to the investment. We think that obviously the state is made a very wise decision in making this investment, and we think that it holds high promise and great promise to enhance the not only capabilities of the university, but more importantly, to bring together the economic engines of the state, align them with the interest and capabilities of the university in ways that create added economic impact for the state. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for Dr. Herman? Very thorough presentation. Thank you so much for your work. We do think it holds great promise, and we are proud to have supported it.
Madam Chair, I'll invite up two of my colleagues next, and they'll introduce themselves, but Kathy Brown and Mike Volna, to help me take you through the a very deliberate and hopefully thorough update on the Huron and Simpson reports for new members or members that don't have, like me, have forgotten about the name of that newspaper article.
What newspaper article?
I don't remember that one. We engaged back in the fiscal, in calendar year 13, two consulting firms to assist the university in assessing its human resource, finance and procurement, and information technology. And it's also in terms of doing an analysis of spans and layers, the organizational structure and supervisory levels at the University of Minnesota. Both Kathy and I and Mike here will give you some updates on where we are in those studies and put some context around what we've accomplished and what we're working on today. So with that, I'll turn it over to my colleague Kathy Brown, who will introduce herself.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kathy Brown, and I'm Vice President for Human Resources at the University of Minnesota. Thank you for having us today. I am going to talk a little bit about what we call the Huron Report. Huron is a consulting firm that we utilized about a year ago to give us some recommendations about human resources at the university. I have listed on the slides the top five kind of the high-level recommendations from that consulting company, and the checks indicate that we have addressed each of those. And with that, I would also say that the work is never done, so the check means we have given it considerable time and attention, but these are all areas which require ongoing activities, and so we are constantly refreshing our work in this area and setting new goals, new directions. So the first is align our human resource programs and services with our HR strategy. Our HR strategy is really to define, simplify, empower, and deliver, just in four quick words. And I'm just going to give you an example of one area where we've made a lot of change. We have taken our leadership and talent development area, and we have focused on employee engagement. We did an employee engagement survey a year ago. We did a second one just this past October. We are very pleased to report we have very high levels of engagement at the University of Minnesota in both faculty and staff. We've had high levels of participation in the survey. Any survey we had done previously, we only had about 38% participation. In this one, we have 52% for faculty and 62% for staff. Those are very significant improvements, and the level of commitment and dedication at the University of Minnesota among its employees, both faculty staff, is in the 70% range. So this is very strong. One area where we found that we needed some additional focus is in our mid-level management. So we have created some mid-level management leadership training to ensure that we have those people well-trained and prepared to meet the challenges of their role and to provide leadership to our staff. So that's something we're working on right now. We have staff going out and meeting with every single college and unit on campus, giving them their engagement results, along with several supporting them in action planning so that they can address those results. So this is an active, ongoing initiative. The second one is evolving service delivery, continue to develop our centers of expertise, and I'll come back to that in a couple of slides. Our third one is define HR generalist roles and accountability. One thing we have done is ensure that there's a human resource lead in every college and unit on campus. Those people have a dotted line reporting relationship to me as the Vice President for Human Resources. We meet with those people monthly. We have common and regular lines of communication. So we are both supporting the work that they're doing out in the on the front line, so to speak, but they are also supporting the policy work and larger strategic program development. This has been a very good exercise, a lot of active engagement of the HR community very broadly across not just the Twin Cities campus, but the entire system. So we're working across the system here. The fourth one, formalized data integrity program. We are in the process of finishing that up with our upgrade project, and I'll come back to that in just a moment as well. And the fifth one is define and implement HR performance metrics. Those have been developed and will be delivered at our Board of Regents meeting in February. We will provide those to our faculty and staff committee. So we have made significant progress in every area. Again, I emphasize this is work that's never done. So
Ms. Brown, yes. Could you just give us a flavor of what a performance metric might look like?
Surely. Madam Chair, members of the committee, some of the performance metrics are about the demographics of our workforce, the amount of spend on our workforce over time, benefits. We have demographics on diversity. Those are some illustrations.
Thank you. Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Brown. I was curious about what you were talking about in terms of your surveys that you have done recently, and I'm curious to hear. I'm new to the committee and new to delving into the U of M functions, but I come from a corporate background, and we did surveys annually, and our chief executive of HR really read every single comment that the employees would have. So I'm curious to get a little background from you. How often do you do these? And you know, you can't improve what you don't know, you know. So in this case, are you planning, is it more systematic that you will do these every year? And how are you applying those learnings and to make improvements with staff and with faculty?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Brown.
Madam Chair, Senator Franzen, members of the committee. We are doing these on an annual basis. We did the first one last October of 13. We did one in October of 14. So those are the first two of this type. And this is truly an engagement survey where we are asking our employees about how engaged they are in their work, how dedicated they are, what things are working for them, what barriers are present for them in their work. It's a relatively short survey. It's about 30 questions, but I think quite comprehensive, and we really look at the drivers of engagement as well as how much people are feeling engaged. And as we have developed this work, we then take data for each individual unit. We meet with the dean or vice president, and we have it broken down into units as small as 10. Below that, we stop so we don't invade individuals' privacy in the matter. But we have feedback to every individual leader about what their employees have reported. And it does have a place for open-ended comments, and we do read those and review those with the leadership. And then our staff has spent a lot of time preparing some action strategies. So if development has been an area that your staff feels is weak, then we have some strategies about ways that you could help do staff development, many at no cost. Things you could do inside, resources that we have on campus that you could bring in, other options available for staff development. And so my staff is trained to actually support units in creating an action plan. Some units have done this very aggressively and have had very good results. Other have had many pressing items on their agenda and have spent a little less time and are finding that things don't change overnight without a little help. So this is a process. We have not used this as an evaluative tool. We have used this as a developmental opportunity to make sure we're understanding what's important to our employees, how we can best address and support their needs, and to really put some action steps in place to improve the work environment. We're very committed to being an employer of choice and really making this a great employment experience for the benefit of our mission and our students.
And Madam Chair, I might also add that the president actually, in our meetings with him one-on-one, uses those documents to talk to each of the vice presidents. And, of course, we all want to beat his office.
Very good.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to expound on that. This is a program that has actually had national recognition with the Professional Organization for Human Resource Professionals in Higher Education. And Dr. Brandon Sullivan is on my staff and has represented and done a national speech on this. So we've had a lot of national attention with our program and are very pleased with it. Ongoing human resource initiatives that are worth note here today that are large is the improvement of our human resource management system. We are partnering with our finance colleagues, our student affairs colleagues, and our information technology team to improve the enterprise management systems at the University of Minnesota. This slide lists some of the benefits that we will reap when we get this done, and we are very close to setting a go-live date for this a little bit later in the spring. Another big initiative we have is the job family study, and this is related to the Simpson work. I've got a slide on that a little bit later on. But the job family study is really to identify every individual in our professional staff and our civil service staff to look at their job and create a classification structure that accurately reflects what they do and put it in a market comparative salary range so that, again, for employees, this is good because I know if I'm in this position, if I want to advance, these are the things I need to do. These are the potential ways that I can move forward, the potential salary structure I might be looking at. If I'm looking at a position in College A versus the one I have in College B, I can tell if that's a lateral move or a promotional opportunity. So it's very helpful to our employees, and it's been very helpful to our managers, too, because as we've gone through and identified this, we've had about four steps at an entry level, then higher-level professionals that are doing ongoing individual contribution, and then supervisor and management track. So we are better able to track who is supervising and managing people, what skills do we need to develop in them, and so forth. And we also have very high-level individual contributors. And so people are not getting a promotion into a manager position. If they don't really want to manage people, they can continue to accelerate their career through an individual contributor track. We've also found that managers said, gosh, I didn't know I had so many people at this level. Maybe I need to rethink my structure a little bit and spread out my skill sets. So it's, I think, been a nice way to shed light on our workforce. It's been helpful, and we will be finishing that later this spring as well. A couple of centers of excellence that I would highlight here, and one is redesigning workflows to target our most common sources of processing bottlenecks in hiring. And we had a priority hiring process For people who have worked at the U and may be changing jobs or may have a layoff, be looking for a new job. And then, of course, we post and look for both internal and external candidates. We used to do those sequentially. Now we do those concurrently, and that has shaved off a number of days of our hiring process. So if you look on the lower right-hand corner of that slide, we have reduced the number of days for faculty hiring by about 50 and halved the number of days to hire professional staff. So these are some processes that we've put in place. The second one is delegating human resource tasks to the most appropriate level of staff. And so we put in a call center or a contact center, if you will, in the Office of Human Resources, and we have self-service. We have Tier 2 as administrative services, where common questions, how can I change the deductions on my W-2 form, popular question this time of the year. Tier 3, subject matter experts, I'm having trouble with my insurance coverage. I'm going to have a surgery. I need some help in making sure that really gets squared up. And then Tier 4 is policy experts, where we're really looking at significant policy questions and working with them. This has helped us be more efficient in providing good service to employees who have needs. And the final thing I'll speak to today is just a review of what we call the Sibson Report. That was the consultant that helped us look at spans and layers. This is a human resource tool, and it's really to look at the organizational structure to determine how many layers, so how many layers from the bottom to the president, so that's the steps up, and then the width is spans, and that is how many people report to an individual supervisor. And this was from fiscal year 14. We have done a repeat of this test. I have it on my desk. We haven't processed it all through to a final conclusory report as this is, but I'm absolutely certain there's not going to be significant differences. We will have less than 7 layers in every aspect of the campus, and our spans are still going to be in a range of probably 3 to 11 on average. And there's a lot of reasons that we have some units that have broad spans and some units that have narrow spans. In areas of expertise, you may even have a single employee reporting to a supervisor. And it doesn't really make sense to combine that in different ways because it's a very narrow of expertise. In some areas, we may have up to 30 in a wide span because it's work that is more routine, can be supervised more easily by a single person.
So, Ms. Brown.
Yes.
So, if you look at the Twin Cities Colleges
yes.
line and then the 19,
yes.
just give the members some indication of what that means. What's that a reflection of?
That would be 6 layers down in our organization. So, this would be a frontline supervisor. And the average there would be 19 direct reports. And that probably comes out in a college department where you may have a single department head and there would be both faculty and some staff that would report to that department chair or head, we would call them. So that would be a frontline supervisor in our organization.
And so if you followed that, in the second line, 2.82 under the 2?
Yes, for so Twin Cities Colleges.
Mm-hmm.
That might be the dean
okay.
in that college, and that dean may have...
2 associate deans. Or
yes, something like that. 2 associate deans. Sometimes they have a half-time faculty person that works as an assistant dean. So that's what would be reflected there. And this is an average, so some might have more. Some, a smaller college, might only have a single person.
And so as you look at just this snapshot, which you're sharing with us here,
yes.
are there areas of concern that you would flag and say, gee, I really want to work on this?
I actually think, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I actually think our spans and layers is in pretty good shape. There are individual pockets that aren't reflected in this chart specifically, where I might question if somebody has 35 or 40 direct reports, whether that is a reasonable number that is probably too large of a number to manage efficiently, even for routine work. If there are areas where there are what I would call the onesies, twosies, those are areas that we should take a look at. Again, those don't necessarily show up on this high-level compilation chart, but do show up on the charts that I have on my desk back in the office for each college and unit. And we will be sharing those with leadership and discussing those with leadership as they continue to reflect. These are the same layers of management that we use in our employee engagement survey. So we are actually reviewing this in a couple of ways, both in just a structural review, but also as we're going through our engagement data, we're talking about how many people report, how's that going, what's happening. So we're looking at it both in a form and substance kind of approach.
So it just should be noted, this is a big change because, you know, in 2000 and 2 years ago when we first started this conversation, you hadn't yet done a spans and layers report. So it sounds like not only have you done it, but you're really making use of it in your management.
Thank you. Yes, we're certainly working at that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to shift away from human resources now back to finance and procurement projects that were highlighted in the Huron report, the status report there, and what we're working on. And I will again turn to my colleague, Mike Volno, who will introduce himself.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mike Volno, Associate Vice President for Finance and Controller for the University of Minnesota. I will cover with you some of the projects and recommendations that have been completed since the report was delivered, and also some of the things that we have been in the process of working on. I would I'd like to start with the completed projects. One of the things that we had been working on initially in the infant stages and that Huron really endorsed was the implementation of an electronic procurement system, much like eBay or a Amazon.com for internal use at our institution. Many research universities have done this. We had not had an opportunity to do that. We were in the process, as I say, of putting it in. Since Huron finished, we have put it in. It was an extremely successful project, as opposed to many where we kind of went into it slowly. We went very big bang, went with 38 of the largest university vendors on day one. What we have seen and what we have achieved with that is, first of all, there's really been a lot of process improvements. We have eliminated paper invoices floating around. We've streamlined a lot of the electronic transmittal of activity back and forth between us and the vendors. And secondly, what we've been able to do is use the tool to drive departments and university purchases to the vendors that have the best contracts and the best prices for the university. So we're really happy with how that has gone. Second, one of the recommendations was that there's a lot of paper that floats around in terms of paying vendors. And so we had been starting down a process of looking at ways to do that. We've since implemented a number of different electronic vendor payment mechanisms, whether it be purchasing card, ACH payments, or what we call a virtual payment card for accounts payable. What we've really been able to do there is reduce the amount of paper, as I said, that's been floating around, the cost of issuing checks, and so forth. And secondarily, many of these electronic payment mechanisms also provide a rebate back to the institution. And we've been able to approach $2.5 million in rebates to the institution in all of the various electronic payment mechanisms, which has really been a great way to fund some of these projects without asking the institution to pay for them. Third, we've been able to drive some of that same technology into some of the payment processes involving students, particularly international students and the movement of money between the United States and other countries. As you know, since 9/11, there's been a lot of focus on international payments and the movement of cash across borders. That's created a lot of cost, a lot of barriers for institutions. We've been able to implement some things that essentially have taken about $200 per payment per student out of the process. So we feel very good about that process. And finally, as with a lot of large institutions, we have a lot of payment activity, but the really large dollar complex ones are a small percentage of that activity. And we it was recommended that we implement a vendor management, contract management tool as a way of being able to track all of the terms, conditions, milestones, deadlines, and so forth that come with some of these contracts. We've implemented that, and we are using it to track various contracts to make sure that as those contracts, as those vendors deliver their goods and services in accordance with the contract, we're getting best value and all the things that we need from the contractors. Some of the things that we continue to work on and that we really are excited about finishing up, one of them I think is near and dear to Mr. Fitzenreiter, and that is the adoption or adopt a risk-based procurement threshold and authorization process. We have a very elaborate set of rules and requirements for what gets authorized, what gets approved. Those all have dollar amounts. Those all have assigned accountabilities. They are old. It is probably a decade old, and the federal government has adopted some new requirements and new rules for that. We are taking this opportunity to go back and look at all of our dollar thresholds and how many are required and what do they really mean as a way of streamlining and simplifying some of that back office bureaucracy that sometimes accompanies these activities. We plan on having that done later this calendar year. A second one that we really are excited about is implementing some new cash handling techniques and tools for research projects that need them for what are called subject payments. Some of these projects involve the use of 50 or 100 different subjects for a part of the study. We typically will give them a small dollar amount as a payment for participating in the study. There's a balance that has to be met between privacy and IRS requirements, and it is a very challenging balance that we try and strike. There are new tools and new processes, such as preloaded or reloadable cards and such, that really have been used at other institutions to simplify that. We have that on our schedule. We will be doing that this year as well. And finally, one of the big ones that we're really think is going to have a big impact is we are planning on implementing new tools, new policies, new procedures to automate the book to travel to reimburse process. What we use today is a hodgepodge of our enterprise systems, some third-party vendor systems, some paper forms, and so on and so forth. There are a lot of new tools that really enable the use of the web, enable mobile technology, allow you to capture receipts on your smartphone, upload them, create your request for payment, and so on and so forth. That's a bigger project that we will have started later this year. We expect to finish that in 2016.
Very good. Thank you.
Yep. Madam Chair, members, our Chief Information Officer, Scott Studham, was unable to be here today, so I'm just going to sub on an example of two projects in that area that we've been working on and have completed at least partially. First one being a software rationalization effort that's underway at the university. We have over roughly 160 unique enterprise application software that we purchase and pay for. And we're going through a process of determining whether we, how many users there are of that software, do we really still need that software, and that's all about rationalizing that software. We've been able to retire so far 30 custom applications, resulting in a decreased need to support those software programs. That process is underway today. Big effort there by Scott Studham and his team. We've been working for quite a while now on the help desk realignment. We've completed 46 help desks, realigned them and consolidated them. We've got six help desks are planned to be aligned with that 46 in the next 10 months. There are 12 help desks still to go, and so far we have realized $2.3 million in savings through this particular effort, which was, again, a recommendation in the Huron report. With that, if there are any questions, we'll,
please tell Scott Sudham that we appreciate his efforts, and we're sorry we weren't able to see him today, but congratulations.
Thank you, ma'am. We want to move next. I'll bring up another couple of colleagues that I think the committee is also familiar with from previous times in front of the committee. But from here on, we'll move into reporting back to you on now on the performance measures and the statutory requirements for reporting certain financial and other data to the committee. If there aren't any other questions,
it looks like Senator Torres Ray has a question. Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering, you know, when we get this information about the savings, it's so exciting because obviously we're getting into new technology and creative ideas. I'm just wondering where the savings go. We never get a report on that. So when we hear, you know, tip $2.3 million on savings for aligning all of this, I wonder where these savings actually, what happened to them? Do we receive a report on that?
So, Senator Torres, that's a great question. You're going to get in way more detail all the various places where they did save, but the where it went, let's see what they say.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senators, it partly will be talked about as we go through the material, but in the internal budget process, when we capture these savings, so for example, I don't want to get too far ahead, but the president has a goal of reducing administrative costs by $90 million over 6 years. We're going to report to you today. We're well into that process. Those savings are captured in our internal budget process, our annual budget process, and those dollars are reallocated. The president wants those dollars saved and reallocated to pay for primarily mission activities, as well as to reduce the cost of attendance for students. So it's in the internal budget process that we capture and reallocate those dollars, with the priority to be cover inflationary costs, keep the cost of attendance down for students, and invest it in mission activities.
Just another comment to that, though, Fitz. I think, so for example, when you do your budget request for us, I think this, one of the things that is on our minds is when you request taxpayer dollars, for example, to freeze tuition, I think we might say, well, what percentage of your reallocation did you put towards keeping your tuition low or reducing tuition? Because that's, you know, cut to the chase, and I think that's what we want to know.
Sure, Madam Chair. And it probably take a little more time, and we'd be happy to come back and talk.
When you do your budget request, we'd love that.
We can have a conversation about how we incorporate that, what will be $30 million in reallocation over the next 2 years, how that factored into the amount that we asked from the state of Minnesota. It is absolutely factored in.
Senator Miller?
We can show you that.
Thank you. Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Fitz, or just a detailed list on maybe not how it bought down tuition, but we saved $30 million, and here's how we spent that $30 million. I think would be helpful, like in a spreadsheet form, some sort of detail, pretty black and white, just the numbers and where it went.
So, Madam Chair, with
thank
that,
you.
We'll
great.
Turn to Lincoln Carlson first here to, again, talk about the performance measures and report the results of the legislation from 2013. Lincoln.
Great. Madam Chair, members, my name is Lincoln Carlson. I'm the Director of Institutional Analysis at the University of Minnesota. As many of you remember, as part of the 2013 laws, 5% of our allocation, $26.5 million, was held conditional upon the university meeting three of five performance measures. And those performance measures are before you. They were to improve graduation rates for low-income students, a 4-, 5-, or 6-year graduation rate. We, along with legislative staff, defined that as Pell-eligible students. Improved graduation rates for first-time, full-time degree-seeking students more broadly. Members wanted a system-wide number, and so we looked at 4-, 5-, 6-year graduation rates system-wide, counting as a success as we do internally, perhaps a student that started at Duluth but graduated from Morse. When we get into some of the iPads data, we don't get to count that all the time. We don't get to count it at all for iPads. Third, increase the total number of undergraduate STEM degrees, science, technology, engineering, and math. Along with staff, we took a – there's many definitions of STEM degrees. We took one of the broadest available. So we are capturing degrees in agriculture and natural resource sciences and the health professions. Increase invention disclosures when faculty create an invention. We require them to disclose it to the Office of Technology Commercialization. That's to protect university intellectual property, but also to help the faculty member with next steps. And so that's a process that we had in place. And then the last one, which we'll nobody will really care about, the decrease administrative costs by $15 million. And when you have questions on that, I will turn to Julie. So the next slide is the results of those. So just to orient you to the table, you have the measure, the baseline that we started from, the target increase that was in statute, the target value, which is the statistic that we had to meet, and then our actual result on each measure. I'm pleased to say that we achieved all five of five on those measures, and quite significantly in some cases, especially around the graduation rates.
So those are astounding, you know, that's an astounding improvement. Could you share with us how that happened?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, so there's a variety of things going on there. The it's important to understand that the in the cases of the graduation rates, in law, these are written as three-year averages, and we appreciate that because in any given year, obviously, your graduation rate can bounce up or down. So that was an intentional smoothing. But in the case of graduation rates, as you'll see later on in the presentation, our graduation rates have been increasing year over year, not insignificantly. And so you're seeing some big jumps because we are grabbing data from 5 years out, in the case of the baseline, all the way to our current year. And so you've built in some cases, it's in an average, but it's part of a five-year trend in some cases.
Got it.
Things like the STEM degrees, that's been an emphasis for the university. President Kaler has made a big push on that. We've increased admission and enrollment targets in the College of Science and Engineering and in the College of Biological Sciences. So those are strategic decisions by the university, and you're seeing the results there. Just to make sure members know, on the administrative cost measure, as part of the transmittal letter, there was 6 pages of detail. I think you received a copy, Madam Chair. Unit by unit, line by line, detailing that $18.8 million. So that's available.
So do all the members have that? I have seen that, and I actually said before the presentation, I thanked you for how detailed you in what you provided us, that was very, very helpful. Do the other members around the table have that? So it's in, members, in your packet. It says Commissioner Myron Franz on the front. So if you go towards the back, you'll find the very detailed explanation of where those administrative cost savings came from. Sometimes people wonder whether or not the increased graduation completion rates are a result of being more selective on admissions. What would you say to that?
Madam Chair, members, again, later in the report, we're going to provide you with as you requested, looking at graduation rates by a variety of cuts, by Pell eligible, by first generation, and so on and so forth. So while certainly the university has become more selective, you're seeing increased graduation rates in a number of different student cohorts.
Okay.
And we'll show you some of that.
Senator Torres Wright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think your question is a question that is relevant to many things. The purpose of providing this direction for the university is because we want to learn from you as to what are some of the creative steps that you take in order to generate this growth. Mm-hmm. So if the growth of, for instance, the first target, which is the increased low-income undergraduate graduation rates, if the increase is due to the fact that more students, we have more families that are low-income and more low-income people are coming to the university, and you have a higher selective process, well, clearly you're moving in that direction. So these numbers do not reflect your effort. They just reflect a demographic trend. So what the university is doing to achieve these results that the legislature put in place for you is not clear to us. And I would like, Madam Chair, if you don't mind, taking a little bit of time to really get into the essence of what you do in order to achieve this growth. Because if not, we're never going to learn. If it was an accident, what we did didn't matter. If you intentionally created a strategy, you said that you have strategies. I am curious to know what those strategies are, because everybody's trying to do the same. Sure. And you as an academic institution probably have some creative minds that are helping you do things that we need to do. So I'm very interested in just dissecting this one, for instance. Mm-hmm. I don't know if this is the time, but I want to know, what does this growth mean? Is it means that we have more low-income students who are actually pursuing because you have incentives, you have counseling, you have whatever it is that you put in place in order to get us there? Mm-hmm. I'm just curious.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members, again, if I could defer please that, just for, because we'll have a whole slide and a whole discussion on exactly that question, including our Promise Scholarship strategy for low and middle income students. Several programs started both in the previous administration and this administration. I'd also encourage you to have Vice Provost Bob McMaster here, Vice Provost for Undergraduate Education, who can speak to those topics as long as you would like to hear him. But I will have some detail coming up on exactly that question.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, will shift.
Oh, I'm sorry, Senator Klassen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to the metrics, we spent some time 2 years ago talking about the STEM degrees, and as you indicated, there's a wide variety of areas within the university that you've used. I'm wondering if you could give more specific information on that, showing us exactly the number increases and the areas. You might not have that here, but if you could provide that, I'd appreciate it.
Madam Chair, members, yes, we certainly can. Like I said, there are a variety of definitions, but they are generally collections of SIP codes, classification of instructional program codes. That's a national standard and sorts degrees into various areas. And we have a variety of SIP codes here, and they are disaggregated. They're on our website, and I'm happy to provide them to you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, members, will shift now to away from, we'll be back to some of those same topics, but to shift now to giving you the information that was required to be submitted pursuant to Minnesota Statutes 2014, Section 135A there. And I will turn to my colleague, Julie, who will introduce herself, and she'll take you through quite a bit of numbers here.
Excuse me, Senator Eakin, before you leave, if you're not coming back, I did want to make one housekeeping announcement. So next week, the Elections Committee will not be meeting at this time, so next Tuesday we will be meeting at 2 o'clock in room 107. Thank you. And so that's all for the people around the room, too, because I know that our meeting time affects many of your calendars. So hopefully we will not cause too much disruption with schedule changes. So very good. Thank you. Please continue.
Hey, Madam Chair, members, my name is Julie Tonneson. I'm the Associate Vice President for Budget and Finance and the Budget Director at the University of Minnesota. And I'm going to take, Lincoln and I are both going to tag team this part of the presentation, take you through different measures that we were asked to provide this year with our budget proposal. The statute then on this slide, the statute did require really a number of information pieces in time series, and we worked hard with MNSCU to agree and with the Office of Higher Education to agree on the time frame that we would provide the data for, as well as on the definitions and some of the display, so that we could be as comparable as possible between the two systems. It won't be exact, but we tried to be very comparable. And so what you see here is the first thing requested of us, which was our expenditures by function over time. And we have chosen here to display this in the first year we provided FY09 and then the last year, which is FY13. So you can see here by function, and perhaps you did talk about this with MNSCU on Tuesday, but any institution that receives federal funding is required to report a number of different pieces of information to IPEDS, the Integrated Post-Secondary Education Data System. And one of those pieces is expenditures by function. Functions that you see on the left side of the chart here are, and we share a common definition across all institutions for these functions, and they are intended to indicate the purpose of the spending. So to answer the question, how does this transaction accomplish the mission of the institution? And in our display here, you can see that we're really relatively stable across these 4 years and all of the major functional expenditures. Most of them are up or down 1% rounded or less as a percent of the total spending. There's only one that actually changed by more than 1%, and that is our institutional support spending as a percent of total went down by 2%. That's the orange slice of the pie. Otherwise, they are all very stable within 1% of each other over time.
Yeah, Ms. Tonneson, so we were actually curious about that because your, the academic support went down, and sure, it was just by 1%, but that actually did equate to a pretty significant amount of dollars, and yet your graduation rates went up. So again, back to Senator Torres-Ray's question, how do you spend less to improve your graduation rates?
Madam Chair, members, we actually didn't, if you look at this over time, we didn't spend less, okay? We spent more because we have more resources over this period of time, but the percent of the total spend went down slightly or up, depending on the category. And keep in mind, this is a over $3 billion budget, and so there's a lot, obviously, of activity that occurs within each one of these categories. And a shift in one particular focused area might change the total, but may not have an impact that you expect.
And Madam Chair, one of the things that, of course, we'll be watching on this pie chart, and you'll be able to watch, too, as we submit this, is how are those pieces of this pie, other than instruction, research, and public service, changing as we do our administrative reductions and our operating efficiencies? Because this is through 13, and the pace of the change as we do the $90 million will affect these slices as well going forward.
Very good.
Madam Chair, members, the second expenditure summary that we were asked to provide is expenditures by object. These are the same totals, just displayed differently. So it's by really what most people would understand as general spending categories here, typical groups of spending. And in this one, again, it is a relatively stable across this period of time. The compensation, which is salaries and fringe combined, is actually the largest change. And again, this is as a percent of the total. Compensation, particularly salaries, went down 3% as a percent of the total. Yes, we spent more, again, overall over this period, but in terms of distributing that spending across the categories, it is shifting between the years.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, one of the consequences of that, or why that is occurring, is this was a period, remember, of the from 09 on, of the Great Recession, and we as a university took steps to control the budget because we were being, our budget was being reduced, tuition was going up, to dampen down and on occasion freeze salaries of all the faculty and staff at the University of Minnesota for some periods of this time period.
Yes, Madam Chair, members, there were two salary freezes during this time period, also some delayed increases during the fiscal year, so we had a number of strategies specifically designed to impact the salary expense. The next one, Lincoln, is going to take.
Madam Chair, members, this is a chart of direct instructional expenditures per FYE full year equivalent student. You may have gotten similar data from MinSKU on Tuesday. They do a annual instructional cost study, which includes both a direct and an indirect component. We actually do a cost of mission study, very similar, trying to look at both the direct cost of the activity and the support cost of the activity. We only do that on a periodic basis, and so the requirement was to have a five-year timeline, so we shifted to IPEDS data. So we're using the same instructional spend that Julie just had in one of her pie charts. Just a couple data points, and I'll talk about what you're seeing here. One is that until just very recently, our Rochester campus was reported in IPEDS through the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus. Since they had their first graduating class, we now report them separately, and so that's why you're seeing those data points show up. The other data oddity is on the very bottom line, and also it's also in Duluth in the graduate and professional line, where because we're using IPEDS data and the instructional data, but also their definition of a full year equivalent student, they changed their definition for in 2012 for some of the doctoral practicing degrees. So these would be your doctor of nurse practitioners, but also medicine, and we have quite a few of them. And their definitional change caused us to have, their calculation would have a larger number of full year equivalent students, which drove down the expenditure per full year equivalent student. So that's nothing magical happened there, definitional issue. If that definitional issue hadn't happened, you'd be at about $23,300 in FY12 and $24,000 even in 13. So I wouldn't worry about that blip. So a couple things I think just to note here. One is that over this time period, relatively flat instructional expenditures per student. Not surprising given the time period going through the recession. As Julie mentioned, we had lots of budget containment issues across the institution, so on and so forth. But you also notice the variance between and among campuses and levels, and that really isn't surprising to us either. You simply have very different instructional programs on each of our campuses. There are more expensive, many of the expensive instructional programs are located on the Twin Cities campus. When you have an agriculture program and you're running greenhouses and expensive equipment or a medical school, those will tend to be more expensive student programs on a per FYE basis. So this data is very consistent with what we see internally.
Okay. Turning to revenues now, for reporting revenues, that I should have mentioned earlier, the expenditure data that we displayed is actually right from the financial statements for the institution. It reconciles. That was an agreement with MinSKU that we would reconcile and display the information in financial statement view. The revenues are slightly different. We modified the categories here so that they reconcile to the ledger, but they are in more understandable categories, I should say, than the financial statement might be.
So if you would, excuse me one moment, yep. Senator Klassen.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, but going back to your chart on direct instructional expenditures, do you also have a chart that shows the actual enrollment numbers that we can compare the actual numbers to? If you could get that for us, we'd appreciate it.
Madam Chair, members, absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, continuing with the revenues, you can see here that we're relatively diverse and varied in terms of the source of revenues that we have. Our three largest sources, not surprisingly, are the state appropriation, tuition, and then sponsored grants, and that is true for across each of the years in this particular time series. Again, by unit, these are displayed as percent of total, and they are relatively stable with two exceptions. The state appropriation did go down over this time period. If you combine the O&M and the state special pieces combined, went down 6% as a percent of the total, and the tuition went up 3% as a percent of the total. The only other one that changed more than 1% during this time is our grants and contracts went up 2%. So the state appropriation was 24% of the total. It is now in FY13, and since that time, actually, been at 18%. And then tuition has gone up.
But, Ms. Tonneson, how about, you know, we did increase our investment for 2014-15.
Correct.
Do you know what that percentage is now?
I think it has gone up, Madam Chair, members, but not enough to round up to 19%. We're still at 18%. The other revenues also increased in the pie, so its percent of total went up, but not significantly with that increase. So,
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this mix of revenues that the university has is a why should you care about it kind of comment here. This is really an important factor in the university's credit rating. The diversity and varied mix of our revenues is really important to the credit rating that we get when we issue debt.
Okay. Moving on to allocation of the state appropriation, which is another piece we were required to submit. We were asked to report on how the state appropriation was allocated within the institution by unit and then or across the units, and then the methodology we use to make those allocations. So what you see here is the biennial total, so it's both FY14 and FY15 combined, of $1.2 billion, and how it is was allocated during the biennium across the institution. You will see that if you add up the first four colors here, the Academic Health Center, the Twin Cities, non-AHC colleges, our groups of institutional centers, Extension Service, Experiment Station, and our system campuses, kind of the core mission units of the institution, received 93% of the state appropriation. The remainder went to other units that I gave you some examples here, so Gopher Athletics, our global programs, student affairs, and so forth, as well as to some items that we hold as institutional priorities and spread across a number of units, things like graduate assistant support, the MnDrive money before it gets allocated out to the departments, and so forth. The methodology we use...
Question on that, Ms. Tonneson?
Sure.
Do you have more detail for the members of the committee with regard to the Gopher Athletics? We always get asked that question.
Sure. Madam Chair, members, in the report itself...
I guess I do have it right here. So could you... It looks like... Go ahead. It looks like $13 million.
Let me get to the right page here.
Over the biennium.
$13.8 million, yeah. Madam Chair, members, over the biennium. So it's just under $7 million a year.
Their annual allocation is about $6.5 million.
Correct.
Gotcha. Thank you.
And then the methodology, we do not allocate the state dollars on a formula basis. We actually use a process very similar to what the state does with state agencies. It is an incremental base plus minus budgeting process where we review each unit every year. We review all of their revenues and all of their expenditures and make allocation, the leadership makes allocation decisions based on what they believe will be the best allocation to make the unit successful given that set of revenues and cost and investment decisions that go along with that. So there are all of our academic colleges on the Twin Cities campus, our system campuses, and then a collection of other, as we mentioned here, actually receive the state
funding. I should also mention they use this to pay for all of their direct costs as well as their indirect costs or their overhead. So it is a it's a mix of expenses and revenues in our process. So, and then turning to reallocation, we were asked to report on the total reallocation that's part of that budget development process. Since FY14, we have focused our reallocation efforts in meeting the president's goal, as Fitz mentioned, of making $90 million of administrative cuts over 6 years. So it's FY14 through FY19. So in the report, we identified reallocation totals for both FY14 and FY15. Related to this administrative cuts, as Fitz mentioned too, we really work hard to redirect those reallocations toward mission activities, toward the growth and to stem the growth in the cost of attendance, and to meet inflationary cost pressures. It is redirected inside the institution, and I'll get back to that a little bit more here in a minute. But what we reported for FY14 and 15 that we actually have implemented and approved was about $39 million of administrative cuts or reallocation, 68% of which is associated with impacts on positions, on personnel. So that's both position eliminations as well as salary savings that you might get from a turnover in staff combined. And then the other 32% is related to non-personnel, and that is the whole gamut of general operating expenses related to supplies and travel and that type of thing, where units go in and actually make a conscious decision to reduce their budget that they allocate toward those things, as well as reductions in equipment purchases or consultants or that anything really other than personnel. That $39 million in the first 2 years represents 43% of our goal over the 6 years. If you add in what we have right now built into the FY16 plan, which is another $15 million, we will be at 60% at least of our goal after 3 years of the 6 years. So we feel good about where we're at on that. There are also in the budget process occasionally reallocations within the mission activities as well. This is just the non-mission kind of support and leadership and oversight portions of the budget that are displayed here. Now, the reallocations as part of the budget process, as we mentioned, it's very much like I just mentioned in terms of the allocation of the state appropriation. We look at the reallocation targets as a resource in being able to address our cost increases and our investments. So we're asking units to reallocate within their budget in order to pay for what we want to spend in terms of actual cost increases, inflation, utilities, and that type of thing, as well as new investment in program. So we don't, in our annual process, by unit actually say you're going to cut this to pay for this. Instead, what we do is say your tuition is going to go up this amount, which might be totally from an enrollment increase this year, for example. Your tuition revenue is going to go up. You're going to reallocate. You might have additional indirect cost money coming in from the federal government. And so you have a set of resource increases that we look at then compared to what are your cost increases. So you're going to have a salary expense of X. You're going to have inflationary costs of Y. We want to invest a certain amount in new faculty, and how do those match up? And that's the process we go through. So it isn't we don't end up with a nice list of what we're funding specifically out of the reallocation as part of that process. Doesn't mean we couldn't create something, but right now we don't have that list available.
Madam Chair, I want to illustrate the point a little more, an example in my office that ties back to the Huron report and consolidating help desk. So I used to have my own individual in my office, our office, to whenever something went wrong with one of the laptops in the office, I had a person that was employed in my office that I could just go two doors down, get him to come and help. I get a target to cut in the reallocation of $90 million. I had to give up that position in conjunction with the fact that the institution made a decision to consolidate help desks. So I had to cut that position. And some of that money I get to keep because I've got to pay good people to stay. But I also had to give up some of that salary to the budget process itself to be reallocated to pay for increases in library license costs or an academic investment. But we're not going to, we don't sit and say, well, this much of that went over here. It's a pooling and a respending.
And in that particular instance, Fitz, did that person then move over to the help desk?
No, Madam Chair. In order to, and members, in order to garner that $2.3 million of savings, I think that position was eliminated.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Moving to some tuition figures, was requested for to present undergraduate resident tuition and fees over a 10-year period and against peer groups. So a couple things before I get into the data. One is that each of our campuses is fairly unique and each has its own peer group. So for example, at the University of Minnesota Morris, a small liberal arts campus, part of their peer group includes Minnesota private colleges, either that they look like or that they aspire to be like. So McAllister and Carleton are both in the Morris peer group, and that's why you're seeing numbers like that. Obviously, for the Twin Cities campus, many of the large research universities that you're familiar with, so on and so forth. And again, Rochester is not on here for two reasons. One is that they didn't exist in 2004, though. For your information, they are basically tracking the Morris tuition schedule. But also, we will have, as a data person, we are going to have a tough time figuring out a peer group for the University of Minnesota Rochester. It is a very unique place. It's wonderful, but I don't have any like institutions yet. And I'm going to talk with Chancellor Lemkuhl about what he wants, what he's going to do about that.
Okay.
So those are the. The results, I think, broadly, what you'd see is that the rate of increase on our campuses was actually in over that 10-year period. Was the percentage increase was slightly below the peer groups in all cases.
And what would the Duluth peer group? Would that be the border?
You know, Madam Chair.
Institutions?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, members. Duluth. It was interesting. I'm going through and making sure I knew who the current peer groups were before today, and the answer is no. And I thought about that a little bit this afternoon. Duluth, sometimes I think we think of University of Minnesota, Duluth, and maybe St. Cloud State. They're sort of the same size. They're both up there. They're actually quite different institutions. Duluth, obviously, as part of the University of Minnesota, has a research focus. So they have the same tripartite mission of instruction, research, and services our other campuses do. They have a medical school and a pharmacy school up there. And significantly, they have a large accredited engineering program. So you've got a much different mix of programs than many of our state universities. And so their peer group is, if I can read it here, they're places like University of Massachusetts Dartmouth, University of Michigan Dearborn, University of North Carolina at Charlotte. And we norm these based on mission and program and size and things like that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. The next slide is the same type of data for graduate and professional resident tuition and fees versus peer groups. A little more variable, as you'll see. And the other thing to know about this slide is not everybody in a peer group school has each of these colleges. We're, of course, one of the broadest institutions around. And so, for example, Penn State, Texas, Berkeley, Illinois, and Wisconsin don't have dental schools. They're in our peer group. They don't have dental schools. Likewise, there's several that don't have veterinary medicine schools. And so you're talking about much smaller ends even than in some of these cells.
So these are some of the jumps that are the most troubling when you look at, like, for example, law went from 17 to 40, and graduate overall 9 to 16, medicine 18 to 40, really.
And Madam Chair, members, another data point that would probably be of benefit, particularly on a place like the law school, is the fact that in the process of doing that increase, they began to significantly discount tuition. In other words, they raised tuition and gave scholarships to offset the tuition increase. And you don't get to see that part of the equation here.
Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to the undergraduate resident tuition and fees chart, have you ever done a comparison just looking at the Minsky schools in the state of Minnesota, comparing those in similar size, similar degree offerings to the four University of Minnesota campuses?
Madam Chair, members, we certainly look at the Minsky tuition rates, but I would suggest to you that they do not have comparable, especially if you look at Duluth, for example, and which probably looks most like our state universities. As I was indicating, I think the offerings at Duluth currently are broader and in some cases deeper and more expensive than many of our Minsky campuses. But yes, I mean we certainly are aware of what the tuition schedules are at Minsky.
Just a follow-up question, Madam Chair.
Senator Claussen.
As you described the peer group, it seems to be pretty broad across the country. What about just looking at the Midwest? Comparing Iowa State, University of North Dakota, UMD, and so on, to some of those schools. And so on.
Madam
Mr.
Chair, members, we have actually built, to sort of satisfy ourselves around peer groups, which is always an interesting discussion, both at the system level and at a campus level. We've built a tool, which we could share with you, that helps chancellors and others determine and pick peer groups on a variety of factors. We've got about 20 factors built into this tool. And how close are you to institution X on 20-some variables? So we could do that. But what I would want to do as a companion is put some of those statistics together, because I believe I am always surprised how different some of these institutions are that look, if you don't know anything about them, look very similar to the institution you're comparing it to. But it's doable. We have the data.
Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we have a greater out-migration of students leaving our high schools than we have an in-migration to our university institutions. And I'm just, that would be a piece that I'd be interested in looking at, just from the standpoint of another picture of why do we have that greater out-migration? Is that a piece of it, the financial? And I know we have reciprocity in some of those close institutions, but be an interesting piece to look at. Thank you.
Senator Sharon.
Yes, would you go back to your discussion about the Minsky system and its relationship to Duluth? I wasn't understanding exactly what you were trying to elucidate by saying that. And then in addition, could you be more descriptive of what you're talking about being broader and in more depth than the Minsky educational system?
Sure. Madam Chair, members. So what I was trying to articulate is that at Duluth, we have programming, degree offerings that are different and more intense in certain areas than a typical Minsky university. And the best undergraduate example is in the College of Science and Engineering. So that is one of their biggest programs. Science and Engineering is, as an accredited program, is not common, certainly. That costs additional resources. It's an intensive curriculum. That is going to have a different cost structure and therefore a different tuition structure than a university that does not have one of those. Likewise, by virtue of having a medical school and a pharmacy school there, they do have several pre-med, pre-farm type of courses that make a lot of sense because a student might want to go there as an undergraduate and go on and do their graduate and professional work there. Those are courses that might that probably wouldn't exist in a Minsky college at Southwest State University, for example. Does that help?
I understand what you're saying. I'm not sure that is a completely accurate description of all of the offerings at various systems.
Madam Chair, I agree. I do not claim to be an expert on the Minsky system. I would say that there are some unique features at University of Minnesota Duluth that greatly benefits the northeast part of the state.
Thank you. So, members, you know, we started about 10 minutes late, so we could just go, you know, 5 more minutes and come back and finish this next Tuesday, if that would be the will of the committee, or we could finish it up tonight. So, Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And before I sneak out here, I do have a question for Fitz, and I'm just going back to your comments about your IT guy, and I'm just wondering how many people are in your office that particular person serviced that you were able to have a savings by moving over to more of a consolidated system?
That individual served about 8 of us.
Okay.
And I think today, by that consolidation, those individuals are serving considerably more folks than 8.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, one more thing.
Senator Miller.
I can get you the exact number. I just don't have it off the top of my head.
That would be wonderful. And Madam Chair, in the beginning of the committee, you recognized several folks, and I think we forgot to recognize maybe the main reason why we're here in this committee.
Thank you, our students.
So I think we should have the students stand up. And maybe stretch out just a little bit. But we want to thank you for all your work and your efforts. And it is, I think sometimes it gets lost in all this budget stuff and everything that we discuss here in the committee, but you are the main reason why we're here, and we want to thank you for
so
that.
On the record, my apologies, because that is why we're here, and so please do stand up, students, so we can all acknowledge you. Thank you so much. Thank you, Senator Miller. Very good. So I have gotten kind of the informal members would prefer to come back. And so you had made that offer also, Fitz, so I do appreciate that. And we will, as I said, we'll be back on Tuesday beginning at 2 o'clock. And I know we also have on the agenda on Tuesday a review of our private colleges, so we'll just keep on going. So thank you so much for the thoroughness of your work. And Senator Torres-Ray, I noticed the very next slides were about the questions that you asked. So I want to be fresh and make sure all the members are here because I think they're important.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
So committee is adjourned. Thank you.
Think about signing up. Yep.